You're listening to this podcast, so I know you care about the war in Israel right now. And you've been reading the headlines. Massacre in Gaza. Genocide perpetrated by Hamas. No, by Israel. But if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you know one thing. This stuff seems complicated. And honestly, no one can really just pick a side or decide an opinion without really learning, without really knowing what you're talking about. And that's where this podcast comes in. Check out Unpacking Israeli History, now in its sixth season. They have episodes with topics ranging from what is Hamas anyway, to whether Israel should ransom captured soldiers, and the history of Israel and its disengagement from Gaza in 2005. Unpacking Israeli History cuts through the noise and helps you understand Israel's present through understanding Israel's history. So, educate yourself. Learn the history behind the headlines. Find Unpacking Israeli History wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Amanda Borshaldan. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me. Today is January 18th, Monday, and I'm joined by David Horovitz, the Times of Israel's editor, and our military correspondent, Judah Ari Gross. Thanks for coming, guys.
Hey, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
We have a lot to talk about today. Two rockets fell from Gaza overnight. We'll discuss that. Also, strikes are heating up in Syria. In the past couple of weeks, we've heard several reports of strikes. Is this just a proxy battlefield against Iran? Judah, first of all, tell us a little bit about the rockets that fell last night. What kind of rockets were they and where did they fall?
In the pre-dawn hours of this Monday morning, two rockets landed a bit off the coast of Ashdod, which is relatively central along Israel's coast with the Mediterranean. They didn't cause any rockets alarms because they were landing in the sea and not near any populated areas or anything. But Ashdod is quite a bit farther than most rockets sort of go. So obviously it raised a number of eyebrows. And in response, about an hour or two later, IDF fighter jets targeted a few Hamas tunnel digging operations in the southern Gaza Strip. Pretty quickly, as it has in the past few times that rockets have been launched during inclement weather, there's a suspicion raised that the rockets were not set off deliberately, but because of poor wiring and a lightning strike. So that is being investigated yet again. There's actually video of the rocket launches showing that they come about a moment after lightning strikes nearby. So there's some questions about it. At the same time, if you sort of arm rockets and point them at Israeli cities, you can't really say, oh, it was an accident because you pointed a loaded gun at somebody. And when it goes off, that's your fault.
I've been in Israeli journalism for over 20 years. You've, David, been in it much longer. But during this whole period, it feels like Iran is this ever-looming existential threat. As somebody who grew up in the 1980s in North America with the whole Cold War and Red Dawn and all sorts of Star Wars and nuclear bombs going to fall on us any moment in school, we had drills. I can't help but wonder, how real is this Iranian existential threat to Israel? What is your sense, David?
Well, you know, the people who we like to rely on, the real wise people who've been at the very helm of relevant apparatuses, prime ministers and intelligence chiefs, are pretty adamant that Israel does not face existential dangers, that we're sufficiently strong. You've heard that from prime ministers, and you've heard that from, you know, even I think 2 weeks ago, I was speaking to Ephraim Alevi, who, the former head of the Mossad. You know, Israel is invincible, he said at one point in the conversation. So that's great. So why are we so worried? Because on the other hand, you've got this regime that is, you know, causing terrible harm to its own economy, that is holding its citizens hostage, really, because it's turned itself into a sort of international pariah because it's pursuing a nuclear weapons capability. And the differentiation between, you know, Iran, Israel and the Cold War is the concern that this regime is not what we would describe as rational, that it might be prepared to sustain a second strike in the way that was unthinkable in the Cold War because of the prize of, you know, wiping out Israel or, you know, other issues that are supposedly driving this Islamist regime. So, you know, I don't think Israel is in panic mode, but I think it's very widely believed here that when you have a rapacious ideological regime and it says it wants to wipe out your country, you've really got to take them very seriously.
In the past several weeks, we've been hearing more and more about strikes in Syria. Judah, you wrote a very interesting in-depth analysis of it, and I couldn't help just feeling like it was an outsourced battle against Iran. Is that assessment correct?
So Iran, generally speaking, sort of outsources its efforts in the region, and it has a lot of proxies throughout the Middle East and North Africa to a certain extent, and the Gaza Strip, and in some ways in the West Bank, but to a much less extent. So this plays out with Hezbollah being an Iranian-backed sort of military. It's not even, you know, we call it a terror group, but it's a pretty proper military these days. Hezbollah is in Lebanon, and you have the Houthis in Yemen. And in Syria, there are a number of Afghani and Pakistani militias that are operating there. In Iraq, there's a huge number of, you know, Iranian-backed militias. And these are all things that they're all involved in their own sort of regional disputes. I mean, Hezbollah is a major political player in Lebanon. And, you know, in Syria, they're not only fighting against Israel, they're also fighting on behalf of Bashar Assad's regime. In Yemen, the Houthis are obviously sort of fighting against Saudi Arabia and the UAE in that horrible civil war, and in Iraq as well. But in addition to that, they all are sort of Iranian proxies acting on behalf of Iran.
So why is Israel more emboldened right now?
It's important to say that Israel has not been, it's not as though Israel has not been attacking, according to foreign reports, Iranian militias and Iranian forces in Syria until now. There's certainly been sort of a step up in the past few weeks. We're in a bit of a transitional period sort of on the geopolitical front. With the Biden administration coming in and the Trump administration going out, and Iran sort of, in addition to its regional nefarious activities, is also building, you know, is also working, also has a nuclear program, which is of much concern to most of the world. And the incoming Biden administration is trying to go through diplomatic efforts to negotiate with them to halt their development of a nuclear weapon. And this is coming after the Trump administration has been using a huge amount of sort of economic sanctions on Iran after Trump pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal 2 years ago. And so there's this window where the big bad Trump administration, in the view of Iran, is leaving, and the potentially more sort of amenable Biden administration is coming in. And if Iran were to forcibly, you know, retaliate against Israel and launch rockets and start fighting with the U.S.'s, you know, main ally in the region, of Israel, it would be more difficult for Iran to negotiate a good deal with the Biden administration. And so right now, Israel sort of seems to be sensing that Iran is less likely to retaliate in a significant way. And it's taking advantage of that and launching larger airstrikes, specifically the one that we saw last week, against particularly troubling weaponry in Syria, which in this case, according to reports, was a significant shipment of missiles, which Israel would be concerned would be pointed against it in the future. And so now is a time when there's this lull where Iran is probably not going to forcibly retaliate. So you kind of, Israel's trying to strike while the iron's hot.
David, we heard reports of Tzachi Hanegbi being very aggressive in his approach about the strikes on Syria and indeed seeming to threaten Iran. Do you think that because he is a Likud central figure and that he is so close to Netanyahu that this is coming from Netanyahu as well?
He's very close to Netanyahu. I think it's probably an exaggeration to call him a loose cannon, but he does have a history of slightly... of statements that are beyond what other people are saying, even people close to Netanyahu. So I don't know how much to make of that. I mean, he was talking, it was a threat if the US rejoins the deal and so on. I don't know how seriously to take it. I think it's very interesting. There was a report here a few days ago, a lot of unsourced reports on Israeli television that presumably come from people who want the word out there but don't want to be linked to them. Saying that, as far as Israel knows, the Biden administration, the incoming Biden administration, is already in some kind of contact with the Iranians about re-entering the deal, as Biden has said he intends to do or wants to do. And the Israeli response, again, the unsourced Israeli response, was not hysterical opposition. It was somewhat sanguine. In other words, you know, if there's to be a return to the deal, Israel wants to be sure that this time it would limit Iran's ballistic missile development and other aspects that weren't in the original deal. So I don't think we can say anything definitive, but it's going to be a real challenge now. Just as there's going to be some kind of friction, and we don't know how much, between the Netanyahu government and the Biden administration over settlements and the Palestinians, there is bound to be friction over Iran, where, you know, Netanyahu lobbied against Obama in Congress, you know, lobbied against that deal in 2015. And you can see a return to friction. How it's going to play out, how bitter the conflict is going to be, we'll wait to see. But the, you know, Israel, I think, broadly speaking, there are some in the security establishment who think that the 2015 deal was not a disaster, that it potentially kicked the can down the road, and that it was a mistake by the Trump administration to pull out. And there are others who just think it's unconscionable and are dreading Biden repeating Obama's error. But it's going to be very interesting to see the way that this plays out now between Israel and the States, with Iran maneuvering very capably and very effectively, as it has done in recent years.
It was reported overnight that Phil Spector recently died. He leaves a very interesting legacy in the musical world, and of course his personal life was a bit in shambles, shall we say. David, tell why he was so significant in the music world.
Yeah, that's a fairly sharp change of subject.
Quite the segue.
But we can accommodate that. No, I think Phil Spector's death presented, you know, quite a challenge for headline writers, because you've got a guy who's in jail for murder, dying, and at the same time, a guy who was, according to John Lennon, the greatest music producer ever. You can be both things, obviously. He said of himself, you know, people have called me a genius, but the genius isn't always there, and there's some borderline insanity. So, you know, I think he was aware of his dark side, again, to understate. Just on the music front, he was an incredibly influential producer. He was a pioneer of the so-called wall of sound, which is sort of building up this musical wall behind, you know, a series of astonishing hits, and then, you know, all kinds of dark side musical production stuff. He produced, at John Lennon's request, a version of Let It Be, the version of the album that most of us know. That includes, for example, strings on a Beatles song called The Long and Winding Road, which McCartney, who happened to be in the Beatles at the time, absolutely loathed. You know, they put out an album that one of the key protagonists didn't really know about and certainly didn't like. He produced an album with Leonard Cohen. You can read, if you're interested, read about how unhappy an experience that was for Leonard Cohen. So this incredibly dominant, brilliantly talented, pioneering, and then, you know, rather dark record producer who then went on to a much more significantly dark private life.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for joining me today. We'll speak again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. A special thanks to our producer, Raoul Woodliff. I'm Amanda Borsheldal.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And on our mothership, thetimesofisrael.com.